Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Still dealing with some lingering wetness in the eastern Corn Belt. Ohio leads that region 47% surplus. And then in the far upper Midwest, North Dakota, which extremely wet in the east, still a bit drier in the western part of the state. Put it all together, 35% of the state reporting surplus topsoil moisture. And then if we start to look at the flip side of things, even though we've improved, still considerable dryness, a concern in much of the western half of the country. That 25% very short to short nationally is actually better than what we saw this time a year ago when we finished up May 29%, very short to short, on our way to a number that topped 50%.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
Our top state this week for topsoil moisture, very short to short, is New Mexico at 88%, closely followed by Texas, 79%.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I'd like to talk about some of the alternative policy solutions that you have examined in the outlook and how those fit into the long-term budgetary and economic outlook that the CBO issued.
California Representative Jay Obernolte at a House Budget Committee hearing with Dr. Philip Schwagel, director of the CBO.
If I am recalling correctly, you expressed some grave concerns that by the end of the forecast period on the path that we were on, that net interest outlays would exceed 8% of GDP, would consume over half of all federal tax revenue, and that if interest rates increased in response to inflation, that would get much worse, and that sometime between now and then, something would have to be done to get the deficit under control. Am I understanding that right?
No, that's right, that the fiscal trajectory is, you know, is challenging now, but the longer we go, the further we go out, it gets more challenging. And we'll have another update of that of the 30-year horizon later this summer. I'm hoping in July. It'll get more difficult, honestly.
In this outlook that we're discussing in this hearing, you examine a couple of different policy alternatives, and you analyze their impacts on the deficit. And you've got a table that summarizes it, the ones that increase the deficit, the ones that reduce the deficit. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me which of those policy scenarios actually have a result in a declining deficit over the course of the forecast period?
So we did a range of alternative scenarios, some with higher spending and some with lower spending. One of the ones that has a lower path of spending freezes appropriations at the current level, and that reduces the deficit. You know, we looked just that looks at just appropriations, which of course is not the biggest part of the deficit challenge.
Yeah, discretionary spending, I think you call it in the.
Exactly.
Okay, but if I'm reading it right, although it reduced the deficit over the baseline, it did not reduce the deficit on an absolute basis. Is that correct?
No, that is correct.
So let me ask again, which of these on an absolute basis, which are the policy scenarios that you've laid out here in the outlook, actually reduce the deficit in, you know, on an absolute basis?
Okay. I mean, so one other one we did here, I'll mention two things. One we did in this report, and then one we'll have later, by the end of the year, is we looked at the spending in the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. That by the budget rules, that gets extended out through the budget window. There's a box on page 77 of the report, which box 3-4, that goes through and shows the fiscal impact of that. And this is just mechanical through the budget rules. And so if that doesn't get extended, that would be substantial enough to reduce the budget deficit. You know,
Not on an absolute basis, though. That change, if I'm understanding right, would not result in the budget deficit decreasing over time instead of increasing. Is that right?
That is correct. Absolutely.
Okay, so here's the crux of what I'm asking here is, why are we not examining policy alternatives that result in an overall decline in deficit instead of an increase in deficit over time, if, as you say, we should be so concerned about this increasing deficit?
I agree. It's a grave concern, and we will have that for you later this year. So it's probably December, we will have a new edition of our budget options volume that goes through a wide range of policies, and we will provide information on policies that change the course, in some sense, change the shape of the river, that really make a big impact on the deficit.
Right. I wish that every outlook that you gave us with these policy alternatives would include those alternatives, just to illustrate the gravity of the problem and the magnitude of the changes that are going to be required to affect, you know, that trajectory.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The ag and drought numbers show ongoing improvement in many of our main Midwestern production areas. Some of those areas are dealing with too much wetness and even flooding as you head into the far upper Midwest.
Brad Rippey is a meteorologist with USDA.
Looking first at the corn crop, as of the end of May, just 19% of that production area is considered to be in drought. Most of that acreage is in the western Corn Belt states of Kansas and Nebraska. That 19% for corn is down substantially from a spring peak of 36% back in mid-March. Similarly for soybeans, coverage of drought is down to 10% of the production area at the end of May, down from 26% in mid-March. One crop that got its rain fall too late to really benefit the crop in most areas is winter wheat. We still see 54% in drought at the end of May. However, that is down from a mid-March peak of 73%, but especially in those southern production areas, Texas, Oklahoma, and even extending northward into the central plains, many of those recent rains coming just a little bit too late to really greatly benefit the crop.
Well, let's go back in time for a moment and talk pork bellies. Donna Hughes is with StoneX.
I was fortunate to be brought up in the business, trading pork bellies with the gentleman who was the largest individual hedger on the exchange. His name is George Siegel, and we traded pork bellies together for about 35 years, and it was my learning ground. And I was fortunate to be raised up in that business with the grandfathers such as George and his peer group, and lucky enough to work with the senior officials of companies like JBS and Smithfield and IBP, Tyson. That was basically my commodity college.
We don't trade pork bellies anymore. Why not?
Pork bellies was listed as one of the original contracts on the CME, and that came after butter and eggs and Milo. And Milo, which is not traded anymore as well. But pork bellies, it was basically the contract specifications for pork bellies. Part of it was that it had to be a skin-on belly. And so, anything that was traded or merchandised for hedging in that way had to have the skin on the belly, which is, the ribs next to the rib, the underside of the hog. And so as time progressed and business changed, food service and all of that, the skins of the bellies actually began to have their own market. And so a lot of the excess product that the pork producers produced from the hog, instead of being skin on bellies, they began to do a larger amount of skinless bellies. And those are not applicable to the pork belly contract as it stood. So as more and more bellies went to skinless, that kind of dwindled down the activity, and we had to delist the contract for lack of activity. And so it was probably about 11, 12 years ago that the contract was delisted. But certainly an era to be remembered, and just a very, very wonderful learning ground for me. Very thankful.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
A dubious streak has been snapped in the latest U.S. drought monitor.
For the first time since November of 2021, we are seeing less than 50% of the lower 48 states covered by drought. The current number, 49.3% of the lower 48 states in drought.
As of May 31st, according to USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
That is down from the beginning of May, 53.8%.
About a 4.5% month-over-month decrease.
We've also dropped significantly from our recent peak of 61.1% of the country in drought back on March 8th of 2022, less than 3 months ago.
The recent 27-week streak was the second longest in the history of the U.S. Drought Monitor. Still active, the record 88-week long streak of 40% or more of the nation in drought. Also of note, decreases in various ag commodities covered in drought. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.
Most farmers and ranchers have room to improve their financial management skills. K-State agricultural economist Robin Reed discusses an online class that she helped put together that is meant to educate producers on making better financial decisions. Once producers enroll in the course, there is a time frame for completion.
You can watch the short videos, do the hands-on activities or homeworks at your own pace. Once you register, you have 6 months to complete the class. But what we recommend is just doing a little bit each night for a couple weeks and just kind of keeping at it. And that's plenty of time to cover the class, but you do have 6 months from the time you register.
Reed reviews the in-depth lessons that this program will cover for its participants.
The basis of this program is talking about how we take our farm records, turn them into financial statements, so balance sheet, income statement, and the cash flow, kind of the three big financial statements of a farm, and then taking that a step further, analyzing those statements, and using what you see to make management decisions on your farm. That might be benchmarking with similar farms, saying, are my finances similar to other similar farms in my region, size, scope, that kind of thing. Looking at the trends, say in your balance sheet, you know, is my net worth growing each year? Is the growth that I'm seeing from my generation of revenue on the farm, or is it just purely, you know, asset growth, land value, that kind of thing? So there's a ton of information that these financial statements can tell you. I think a lot of times we're generating these for our ag lender or our tax purposes, but really the value is to ourselves and what these statements can tell us.
People participating in the class will choose either of two case farm exercises which they can learn from.
We have two case farms that they can choose from. One is a row crop and cattle operation. The second one is more of a CSA, farmer's market case farm. So you have your choice to do either one of them. The idea is you're going to learn about a topic, and then you're going to do an activity to apply that you learned. You're going to build a little balance sheet, fill in some blanks, analyze it, answer some questions. And that really just helps you understand, you know, how you could translate and do it on your own farm and what value that would have.
That was K-State agricultural economist Robin Reed on what the Finances and the Farm online self-paced course has to offer to its participants. For more information, go to www.agmanager.info under the Events tab. This has been Agriculture Today. I'm Shelby Varner.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
It's an important one, and the U.S. government buys, you know, a wide range of goods and services, you know, pays salaries, buys jet fuel, buys everything. And so that has an important impact on spending.
Dr. Philip Schwagel is director of the Congressional Budget Office, says inflation is impacting even the government.
You know, there is a revenue impact as well, since the tax code is based on nominal wages. And then net interest payments go up. So the inflation has an important impact on the government. We haven't, we haven't looked at just that in isolation. We've looked at the net of all these things.
Yeah. When it comes to inflation, Dr. Jared Bernstein is with the White House Council of Economic Advisors.
One of the first things that we worked on is something I mentioned a bit ago, which is supply chains. We hired an envoy to be our government's envoy to the ports on the West Coast, Los Angeles, and Long Beach. And if you look at some of the real granular statistics out there, the amount of time that containers are spent in the ports, they call it dwell time. Dwell times are back down to rates that are much closer to pre-pandemic. Goods are moving from ship to shelf with great speed, such that shelves aside from the baby formula problem, which is a separate set of initiatives from us, shelves are just about as well stocked as they were before the pandemic. So we've managed to help there. At the pump, real challenges there. This is a global price, of course, and I mentioned the impact of Putin's invasion. That's been a real shock to commodity prices, energy most particularly, and refinery capacity has also been pretty low. But the president has helped by releasing 180 million barrels of oil from the strategic reserves the government controls, getting some of our friends in other countries to release another 60 million. Folks have probably heard the OPEC announcement of their kicking up their production. And relevant to many of our ag friends, particularly in the Midwest, the president has provided waivers for E15 ethanol gasoline. So those are some efforts there as well.
Inflation is one thing. The deficit is another.
Oh, my goodness. That's been on my radar ever since I've been in this business. So that is an area that we pay very close attention to. I think the first thing people need to know is that in this year, 2022, we just heard from the very budget office you mentioned that the deficit is expected to come down, to be reduced, by $1.7 trillion, with a T. That's the largest single year of deficit reduction in the history of those records. Now, look, part of that is, of course, fiscal policy coming off and winding down. But a big part of that, about half of it, stems from increased revenues that relate very closely to the strong economic backdrop. So this kind of links the first part of our conversation back to here. We talked about the tightest job market in generations. We talked about families having their balance sheets. We've talked about people getting back to work, earning wages that, of course, spin off tax revenue. About half of that $1.7 trillion is attributable to higher revenues than expected. So that's been a very important part of the story. By the way, that also helps with these inflationary pressures. A diminished deficit means, less government spending, and that should help ease some inflation, too.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
But we won't have a home for future generations if we don't tackle the climate crisis.
Senator Debbie Stabenow is chairwoman of the Senate Ag Committee at a recent hearing on climate smart practices.
Wildfires and droughts out west, early frosts and thaws in Michigan, and torrential flooding in the plains all pose great risk to our ability to produce and distribute food. That's costing us, quite literally. The good news is that while farmers and foresters are directly affected by the climate crisis, they are also uniquely positioned to address it, as you know. Farmers are eager to partner with USDA on cutting-edge research and innovation to increase yields, to participate in USDA conservation practices to protect the soil, and to invest in climate-friendly practices that are profitable and practical for farmers. Our Growing Climate Solutions Act that we've done together, for example, goes hand in hand with the work USDA is doing to help farmers lead on the climate crisis. Finally, all of us can agree that we want to make sure we have a rural economy that helps small towns thrive, gives producers a good return on all of their hard work, and keeps food on our tables.
Can go one of two ways, either the carrot or the stick. Dr. John Bozeman is the ranking member of the Senate Ag Committee.
And this is more focused on EPA than USDA. I believe that there should be a two-year pause on any regulatory changes to currently approved crop protection tools. Producers need the regulatory predictability to plan for the future, and the companies that produce these inputs need the regulatory certainty to bring those tools to the market. American agriculture can meet this unprecedented moment. The federal government should ensure it's not in the way.
Whatever the focus, Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack says it takes a long-term view.
And while billions of dollars are being invested in this food system transformation, it's going to require consistent and substantial funding in the future to ensure that the investments of today are built to last well into the future. As Congress begins work on the next Farm Bill, it's going to need to focus attention on continuing this effort. We believe the Farm Bill presents a critical opportunity to advance a new vision of our transformed food system we're discussing today, a vision that includes a fairer and more competitive food system, consistent with access to safe, healthy, nutritious, and affordable food, one that includes voluntary incentives in climate-smart agriculture and forestry, providing competitive advantage for American producers, one that creates new opportunities for small and mid-sized and underserved producers, and for real good job creation in rural communities. These are the ways in which the Farm Bill must invest in order to address and to address the ongoing need for a transformed food system. At USDA, every step of the way, we're going to continue to do everything we can to turn this vision into a reality.
What are the odds, though, we just run out of money? Dr. Philip Schwagel is director of the Congressional Budget Office.
I think about what could go wrong. And we've done some of this work. We had recent work that we did for Senator Crapo and the Finance Committee on what's the effect, the fiscal effect of higher inflation. We looked at two different scenarios. We're continuing to do some of that. What's the effect of higher inflation and higher interest rates? What would it mean for the economy? And what would it mean for the fiscal situation? I'm hopeful that we'll have more on that later this year.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
In the world market, there was a lot of, I guess, attention to news about Turkey working with Russia, who they're on friendly terms with, to be able to find a pathway to move wheat out of Ukraine into world market channels.
Dr. Dan O'Brien is a Kansas State grain economist who's looking into the volatility in wheat.
The big issue behind that is that the world wheat trade and the world wheat overall, supply demand wise, really feels the effect of the wedge now, I guess we call it, the void of the Ukraine crop not coming into world channels. And again, you're looking at an area that was referred to for decades and decades or longer as the breadbasket of Europe, that being Ukraine. And it's become apparent that when you look at their supply-demand numbers, and again, our colleague Antonio Broyaca has discussed that, the issue of Ukraine having wheat in storage that it can't move, and quality concerns, et cetera. So all that is there. So our wheat market was paying attention to that. And when I say our market in the U.S., it seems that some of the speculative forces that came in and helped to drive wheat up, and again, the July contract that ran up as high as about 1380, 1390, now dropped on yesterday's close down to 1143. So about $2.50 of drop. You know, some of that probably is just the sheer physical reality of a Kansas wheat harvest coming in, even though that harvest will be reduced, it sure seems like, from what we're hearing, from what people would have hoped for. So anyway, we've had that price drop. Still, the overall world wheat supply-demand fundamentals is just tight. World minus China stocks projected by the USDA, even with expectations that about half of normal Ukraine wheat will make it into world channels, and that's probably a pretty heroic projection, still down to 19.5%, and that compares to world minus China stocks juice of 21.4 last year, and that was the lowest in about 10 or 12 years. So historic lows, very, very tight supply-demand situation for wheat, and that's just supporting prices at levels that Eric, that you and I, over the last three or four, five, 6 years prior to this, would have just dreamed of. Couldn't have dreamed we'd be here, but we are. And cash prices, even after dropping $2.50 over the last couple of weeks, in Colby, Northwest Kansas, $10.75 as a cash price, $10.69 in Columbus, $10.47 in Garden City, and those are the lowest prices in the state. But then $11.28, $11.18, $11.28 in Salina, Topeka, Hutchinson. By the time harvest actually happens, it's going to really be interesting to see, you know, what actually rules the day. Will the availability of some wheat supplies be at issue, or will there be a strong rush to gobble up and get control of any supplies that are available? I would think Kansas farmers, I wouldn't be surprised that they won't be that anxious to sell wheat right off the bat because they read these same reports that we do, and they're very aware of that world situation. So I know where we stand right now prior to harvest, but it's going to be really interesting to see what this competitive arbitrage process will do in the next several weeks once harvest starts up. And people will be trying to buy wheat from the hands of sellers that in a lot of cases have two-thirds, three-quarters, hopefully, of their normal yields and want to make sure they maximize price this year.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
In some of our northern production areas, last year, during the peak of the 2021 drought, 90% of U.S. sunflower production area was in drought. That number has dropped to 27% by the end of May. For durum wheat, 100% of the production area in drought in the summer of 2021, that number has dropped to 46%. And for the U.S. spring wheat crop, last year's peak, 99% of the production area in drought, that has dropped to 25%. A lot of that remaining drought is across the northern high plains, and as you move to the eastern part of those production areas for sunflowers, durum wheat, and spring wheat, wetness is a bigger problem than drought this spring.
USDA's Brad Rippey.
We have seen also improvements with the recent rains across the central and parts of the western U.S. hay production area in drought. 36% of the nation's production area currently experiencing drought on May 31st, down from a spring peak of 52%. And the U.S. cattle inventory in drought now at 51%, down fairly substantially from 64% on March 15th.